The Underwood and Flinch Chronicles, Volume 3, Blood and Smoke, written and read by Mike Bennett, Episode 2.
Jolly good then, Flinch. Where did we get to last time?
You and Matthias were leaving the island, sir. You were picked up by a Portuguese ship.
Right, yes. Oh, wait a moment. I say, do you have a light, Flinch?
Yes, my lord.
The sound of puffing, then a lengthy exhalation.
Thank you. Nothing helps a story along like a good cigar, eh? Will you have one?
No, thank you, sir. Though, if you've no objection, I'll have one of my woodbines.
Of course not. Puff away, old boy. Now then, let's see. Ah, yes. So, there we were, I, now going by the moniker of Lord Daniel Underwood, and Matthias in the role of my manservant, Tom Pringle. We'd pieced together a credible story of how he'd come to be washed up there, which was really only a matter of fudging the truth a bit. We said we'd been approached by pirates, but our captain had refused to yield, and so a great battle had broken out, that had ultimately resulted in our ship being sunk. We, of course, managed to swim to shore, but everyone else went down with the ship. The Portuguese captain and his men knew enough English to follow the essence of what we were saying, and there was absolutely no reason to doubt us, especially since I was, quite obviously, a gentleman. Underwood chuckled.
But how did you explain your treasure to the Portuguese, my lord?
Oh, I couldn't bring that with me, Flinch, good heavens! All I took was a purse of gold coin and some precious stones, which I said I'd managed to stuff into my pockets before the ship went down.
So you left the treasure behind?
Yes, I had to. It was way too much to reveal to a ship full of strangers. A shipwrecked gentleman with a purse full of gold can reasonably expect charity and assistance, but to go aboard hauling a king's ransom in gold and jewels... Oh, dear me, no. That's a one-way ticket to the bottom of Davy Jones's locker. Spoils of the sea, Flinch. They could have done away with us and claimed they'd bagged the whole lot after coming out on top in a battle with pirates. No one would have given it a second thought. Oh, no. I only took what I needed to get us passage to Jamaica, and from there to charter a ship to take us on to America.
So the Portuguese didn't take you to America?
No, the ship was a merchant vessel sailing from Brazil to Jamaica, Santo Domingo and Cuba before going up to America. Obviously we had no desire to be going into French and Spanish territory, so we got off at Jamaica. But anyway, enough of that. Let's get back to the story.
Yes, sir.
So, it started, of course, with Matthias drawing the attention of the passing ship. Having spotted them and recognized their Portuguese flag, he lit the signal fire. They saw it and weighed anchor offshore, sending in a boat to take on fresh water and pick him up. He explained that he wasn't alone, but was the servant to a gentleman. So where was this gentleman, they wanted to know? Well, the truth was, I was asleep in that hollow under the fallen tree I'd burrowed out following my first wolf transformation. Not a perfect bed, I have to say. There were all sorts of insects and what have you. But it was either that or the vampire's cave. Call me fussy, but I'll take a few creepy crawlies over a cave full of rotting corpses any night of the week. But anyway, Matthias and I had agreed on a story whereby I was afflicted with a rare skin condition, which meant that I had to hide myself away from the sun during the day. And that's what he told them. I was his oddball master, who went off into the jungle by day to sleep or hunt or whatever, and then came back every evening at sundown. Of course, they weren't a handsome cab service, and they were in no mood to be waiting around at the beck and call of some mad Englishman. However, Matthias assured them that I was loaded and would pay them handsomely for our passage. He also told them I'd be bringing back fresh meat from my hunt. This swayed them, and they sent word back to the captain, who then came ashore himself. I awoke at sundown. I fed upon another of those large rodents for breakfast, and then took the carcass down to camp for Matthias. I caught wind of the new arrivals as I was approaching, and so came stealthily up to the tree line to observe what was going on.
It was obvious immediately that these people weren't pirates, as Matthias and they seemed to be getting on like old pals. I listened to what they were saying. Matthias was evidently talking to the captain and his mate about himself and me. I quickly assumed my new role, adjusted my personality accordingly, and, assuming a lordly hauteur, strolled out of the jungle like I owned it. On seeing our new arrivals, I stopped, apparently stunned to see our rescue at hand. "Hello!" said I. "My goodness! Please tell me the Lord has finally delivered us from our ordeal." Matthias turned and said that it was so, that these gentlemen had indeed come to our rescue and would be happy to take us to Jamaica. "Well, this calls for a celebration," said I, hoisting my kill. "Anyone for Rat?" They looked a little disappointed at that, no doubt expecting wild boar or something, but accepted with good grace. At the end of the day, fresh meat is still fresh meat. I handed it over to one of the crewmen, then, having shown them the colour of my money, we were finally able to bid farewell to the Vampire's Island. The first night aboard, I dined with the captain, his first mate, and a Spanish merchant who was on his way to Cuba. Despite the hostilities between our countries, there was no enmity between the Spaniard and I. Everything was very jolly, and I was on rare form, or at least I was, until dinner was served. Since becoming a vampire, I hadn't been able to take solid food. You'll recall Matthias had offered me some cooked fish on that first night after my transformation, and when I tried to eat it, I'd almost vomited. I was fine with the wine, but as soon as the food was served, I knew that there was no way I was going to be able to stomach it. But what choice did I have? I couldn't very well refuse it. After all, I'd just been rescued from a desert island where we'd apparently been dining on little more than fish and rodents for weeks. I glanced around at Matthias. He stood behind me, waiting on me, as it were, and I could see on his face the sort of longing for my grub that I knew should be on mine. It was chicken, served with boiled potatoes and butter beans. They'd recently picked up supplies in Georgetown, Guyana, and I was told, like I gave a damn, that my rodent would be incorporated into stew for the crewmen. I'm sure they were as thrilled with that as I was with the chicken.
"So, what did you do, sir?"
"And what could I do? I ate it."
"But you said you could have digested, my lord."
"Who said anything about digesting it, Flinch? As soon as grace had been said, I forked in a mouthful and closed my eyes, sighing and smiling with gratitude, trying my damnedest to look like a man who'd been plucked from the jaws of death, then sat at a table with the very bounty of heaven set before him. I chewed slowly, seemingly savouring the flavour, before swallowing it with blissful appreciation. I did this until every last bean had been eaten. Then I mopped my plate with bread and washed it all down with a generous mouthful of wine. You'd never have guessed that I was suffering a gastrointestinal tempest for the whole meal. I remember I belched horribly, but it was taken as a compliment and met with much cheer. I then got up and excused myself so that I might urinate. But once outside, I was straight to the side of the ship, where I immediately proceeded to chunder the whole lot into the sea. Matthias came and joined me. He was unsympathetic, as I'm sure you can imagine. He was due to have rat stew along with the rest of the crew later. I told him he was lucky. Like it or not, at least he'd be able to hold his supper down. And with that, I gave him the rest of the night off so he could go and get some of the stew before it was all gobbled up. I then went back inside for a few more hours with the captain and his guests, where I did my damnedest to derive some nutritional sustenance from port and brandy. I had no luck, of course, but I had a jolly good time trying. Anyway, after they'd gone to bed, I strolled around the deck, alone with my thoughts, until the dawn when I went down below. They had no cabin space for us, so we kept down below deck with the crew. Of course, the ship's deck was by no means airtight, and shafts of sunlight shone down through the gaps between the planks of the decking. So, no hammock for me. I had to sleep on some flea-bitten straw in the corner, under an old blanket and some sacking. It was most unbecoming for a gentleman such as I was feigning to be, but I'd slept in far worse conditions, so I made the best of it. While I was sleeping through the daylight hours, Matthias sat and kept watch over me, ensuring that I remained covered up and unmolested by curious seamen. But, of course, he couldn't be there all day. Nature called, and he had to answer those calls. And it was on such an occasion that one of the crewmen who'd been on the boat that picked us up and had seen my purse decided to take advantage of Matthias's toilet to try and improve his lot in life. I was sleeping when I felt something gently groping at my person. I grabbed it and caught the pickpocket by the wrist. Before he could say anything, I had him on his back with my hand over his mouth. His eyes bulged with fear, for he knew if I reported him, he'd be flogged. His heart was pounding, blood pulsing hard through veins that now stood out on his neck, just begging to be drained. I hadn't tasted human blood since I'd killed Rudge, and now here was a man who had kindly offered himself up to me on a platter. My fangs extended, unbidden but undeniable, and I lunged my head down and bit into his neck. Blood spurted into my mouth, hot, fresh, human blood. I gorged myself, losing all sense of everything other than the blood that was not just ridding me of the hunger, but charging me with energy and vitality. After a while I became dimly aware of something impacting on me, but I was too far away to do anything but slightly notice it. And then I felt an incredible pain shoot through me from my leg. I looked down to see my leg was burning, I mean literally on fire, lying in a shaft of sunlight that filtered in through the decking above. I pulled it back and beat it up with my hands. Then Matthias stepped through the light and slapped me around the face. "Damn you, Brooks, get away from him!" he hissed at me. "Have you taken leave of your senses? I had to pull your bloody leg out into the sunlight to get you to stop!" I just stared at him, dumb with blood and confusion. He pushed me out of the way and fell on top of the thief, pushing his hands over the wound at the man's neck. But the blood was pumping out around and between his fingers. "Help me, Brooks, for God's sake! We can't lose him!" "Why?" I asked. "He was trying to rob me." "Why? Have you lost your mind? We can't just murder a member of the ship's crew, no matter what the reason. For God's sake, man!" He was right, of course. I'd forgotten all about that. I'd forgotten all about everything other than the blood that flowed in the man's veins. I apologized, trying to excuse my behavior on the basis that I'd been overcome with need and that my new instincts had taken over. "You told me, promised me you had those instincts under control, John," said he. And again he was right. I had said that, and I'd believed it too, at least as far as not killing him was concerned. But I hadn't bargained on how my hunger and instinct would react if confronted by so tempting a morsel as a thief caught in the act. Who would? Anyway, I snatched one of the sacks I'd been sleeping under and handed it to him, telling him to use it as a bandage. He took it and, kneeling beside the thief, pressed it over the wound. Blood quickly seeped through, and I had to restrain myself from tearing it away and sucking at it. I crawled away and dropped down into a corner, watching nervously while Matthias did his best to staunch the bleeding. He was muttering prayers as he held the cloth against the ooze, begging God to intervene on our behalf. Fat chance of that, I thought. The only person farther out of God's good books than I was at that time was Satan himself, but I said nothing. I just watched until, eventually, the thief made a kind of choking sound and fell still. Matthias leaned forwards to listen to his breathing. Then he swore and sagged back onto his heels. "What is it?" I asked. Without looking at me, he replied, "He's dead." "Are you sure?" I asked. "I can't have drunk that much, and you seem to have it under control." "Well, you obviously took more than you thought you did," he said. He was very upset. He took the sack from the man's neck, wiping at the wound to see it more clearly, when suddenly he froze. "What's the matter?" I asked him. He leaned closer to the body. "That can't be," he said. "What can't be?" said I. It's stopped bleeding." "Well, it would stop bleeding if he's dead, Matthias." "No, I mean it's more than just stopped. The wounds, they've closed up, Come and see for yourself.
Well, I thought he was mistaken, of course, probably just having trouble seeing in the gloom. So I went over and, stone me if it wasn't true. We were in deep shadow, yes, and the man's neck was smothered in blood and traces of dirt from the sacking. But with my vampire's vision, I could see not only that the wounds were now closed, but also the living heat within the man.
He's alive, I said.
Matthias looked at me, his eyes suddenly alive with hope.
Is he? Are you sure? He's not breathing.
Oh, he's breathing. You just can't see it. It's very shallow, but trust me, it is there.
Well, then, how on earth could the wound have stopped bleeding like that? How could it have closed up?
A thought struck him, and he looked heavenward, as if taken with the notion that somehow God had answered his prayers.
Oh, no, said I. He had nothing to do with this. This is somehow my doing. How? How can that be? It doesn't make any sense.
None of what's happened to me makes any sense, Matthias. Yet nevertheless, it's all real.
I reminded him of how in the cave, after the vampire had bitten me, the wound on my neck had closed. So, Matthias asked, did that mean that my victim was now changed as I had been? Had I infected him just as I had been infected? Well, we didn't know. Then I had an idea.
There's one sure way to tell, said I. In the same way you just pulled my foot into that shaft of sunlight, so you can do the same with him. And if he burns, we'll know.
Matthias agreed, and he took the man by the feet and dragged him out to where the shafts of sunlight shone through the decking above. To our great relief, the man didn't burn.
So it must be some quality of my bite, said I. Just as a snake's bite carries poison, my bite, whatever I am, must carry some kind of healing magic.
The idea of some kind of supercoagulant was not at that time in my vocabulary. But anyway,
test it then, says Matthias, on him while he's still out cold.
And so I did. I bit his arm, taking a sly mouthful of blood while I was at it, and then I dropped the arm and let it bleed. Sure enough, slowly, the wound began to close before our eyes. Matthias bade me to spit on it to see if that would hasten it. I did so, and the effect was hastening indeed. The holes were completely closed within a minute. We were both astonished, of course, and, I have to confess, I was also rather pleased with myself. Anyway, Matthias now pointed out that our next big concern was getting this fellow to keep his mouth shut about what had happened. If he were to spread news of what I'd done, we'd both be thrown overboard for sure. However, I wasn't so concerned. I already had a notion of how my mind could now manipulate the minds of others, and I was keen to test it out on the thief. Matthias urged caution. After all, I couldn't speak Portuguese, and there wasn't much chance that our chum could speak English. But I was undaunted. I slapped the fellow to wakefulness, and as soon as his eyes fluttered open, I grabbed his face in my hands and turned it so his eyes locked on mine. I didn't bother with words, I just thought at him. I concentrated on sending mental images to him, and from the very beginning, from the look on his face, it was obvious that it was working. I tested it by sending him a mental command to raise his right hand, and he immediately did so. I turned to Matthias and announced that I had made him do that.
"Are you sure?" he asked.
I mentally instructed the thief to take his raised hand and slap Matthias across the face with it, and with no hesitation he obliged. After a moment of stunned disbelief, Matthias slapped me around the head in response.
"It wasn't me," said I, laughing.
And then we were both laughing, more with relief than anything else. The thief wasn't going to die. He wasn't going to talk. He wasn't going to do anything unless it was what I wanted him to do. And, of course, what I wanted him to do was come and pay me a visit on deck at about 4 in the morning. However, I knew I'd already taken quite a lot of blood from him and was concerned that a second helping might carry him off. So I planted the image in his brain of him coming to me shortly before dawn with a mate, and I followed it with the question word, comprende? The thief nodded I was delighted. I sent him an image of him washing the blood from his neck, leaving us, and then getting back to work without breathing a word of what had happened. Then I waved my hand at him, and off he went. We watched him go to the water bucket and start washing. He was a little wobbly on his feet, but he'd live. And then he was gone. I remember then Matthias turning to me and saying something like, "This is more than just a pushing back of the natural world, John. There's no natural beast in all creation that can change its shape to that of another, close wounds with its spit, and control the mind of a man just by the power of its will. It's unnatural." "So what is it?" I asked. "What have I become?" He turned and walked slowly, picking his way through the hammocks. Then he stopped and turned back to face me. "I've heard stories of witches being able to change themselves into cats, having magic power in their spit, and even steering men's minds. But you're no witch. A witch is taught, a product of learning, breeding even. You can't catch it from a bite." I thought for a moment, and then a dark realization came to me. I said, "But what if the creature in the cave was himself accursed by a witch, and that curse is what he's passed on to me?"
"Ah," said Underwood aside to Arthur. "Now, I should say, Flinch, that nowadays this must seem quite a queer notion for us to have been batting about. But you have to remember that back then, witchery was a widely held belief, especially among the common folk."
"Of course, sir. I've heard of the witch trials. Were they still current at the time?"
asked Arthur.
"Oh, yes, in Europe and America. The worst of it was over, the reign of terror of Matthew Hopkins and the spread of his lunatic notions in that damned book of his, infecting the minds of Puritan fools throughout England and the colonies. But yes, it still went on. Anything out of the ordinary could be, and more often than not was, explained away as being the doings of witches. So, for us to have come to this conclusion in that age before reason was perfectly reasonable, logical even. Dreadful as it was to us, it made sense. And so we agreed there and then that under no circumstances should either of us ever reveal even a hint of what had happened to me on that island to another living soul. Well, the chances were we'd both wind up on a bonfire."
"Whew, a terrifying thought, my lord."
"Too right. Anyway, that evening was spent, as had been the previous one, with me savouring the captain's hospitality at his table, followed by me later vomiting that same hospitality over the side of the ship. Matthias and the crew had chicken stew that night. He told me he'd got the bird's head, which was a cause of much envy among the other men. He bartered it with another fellow for his weevily biscuit, and both of them felt like they'd got the better half of the deal. Then, later, he and the rest of the crew turned in, and I smoked a pipe that the first mate had sold me and wandered about the deck as before. Until 4 o'clock, that is."
"And I remember checking the time on my watch. It was almost exactly upon the hour when, as obedient as you like, two figures came up from below deck and came towards me. It was a thief and another fellow. I gleaned from the way this new arrival was giving me the glad eye that he was the ship's Molly. I wondered if my mental message to the thief had been misinterpreted, especially when this new chap reached between my legs and gave me a friendly squeeze. He smiled and told me in Portuguese that the thief, José, had told him that I had some money I wanted to spend. At least, that's what I think he said. I had a smattering of Spanish from my time in the army. Wrong language, but close enough. Anyway, I smiled and eased his hand from my family jewels, though not unkindly. I then looked at José and sent him a mental message to leave us."
He turned away and went back down below. I looked up to the crow's nest. The lookout was awake, but barely. He probably saw this kind of assignation all the time, but I felt it was wise to play safe. I turned to my new friend. "What's your name? Tu nombre?" I asked him.
"Ricardo," said he.
I asked him if he had a place he liked to go, and he took me by the hand and led me to where one of the ship's rowing boats was stowed, upside down, to prevent it from filling with rain. He got down and crawled underneath it, and I followed him. Once I was under, he immediately started kissing me. I stopped him and pushed him back, exposing his neck. His hands were in my hair as I lowered my face to his throat, where the veins were pulsing with his arousal. I drew back my lips, clamped my hand over his mouth, and sank my teeth into him. He convulsed and tried to cry out, but my hand was fast over his mouth. For a few seconds he fought, and then the bliss from my bite began to work its sedative magic. He relaxed and started caressing my head and neck as I drank from him. All the while I kept repeating to myself, "Don't take too much, don't take too much." But as always, the effect of human blood had an intoxicating effect, and had I not noticed the dead weight thud of his arm hitting the deck as it fell from me, I might well have drained him to death. I broke off from him, swallowing the blood in my mouth and trying to summon some spit. Once I had some, I spat it onto the bite. The bleeding began to slow. I summoned more spit, and a thicker, more viscous saliva came to my mouth. I spat it onto the wound and applied it with my fingers, watching, fascinated, as the punctures now closed up completely. Then I wiped my mouth and checked his pulse. It was strong enough. He'd most likely sleep there until noon, but he'd be fine. I crawled out from under the boat, aglow with the flush of blood, and delighted with my first thoroughly well-managed non-lethal attack. I realized also that I was getting that tingle of warning that announces the approaching dawn. I looked up, seeing that the lookout was now dozing in the crow's nest, and that beyond him the stars were beginning to pale with the oncoming morn. And I remember, I felt good. For the first time in a long time, be I the product of witchery or damnation, I didn't care. I was alive. I was fed, and I was, in spite of everything, happy. I took out my pipe and lit up. The dawn was coming, but I felt that under the circumstances, one last celebratory stroll around the deck was a risk worth taking.